tell me what's happening, what's the fuss? 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 Tell me what's happening, what's the fuss?
Welcome to Friday. Welcome to KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. We're going to spend the next hour figuring out what the big news of the week meant, what it says about us. So, you live in a single-family home in Seattle. Well, make some room. Some people on a Seattle committee think the city should do away with single-family zones and allow duplexes in those neighborhoods, mother-in-law units, backyard cottages. We're going to tell you why that is and figure out what your reaction to it says about you. Crosscut columnist Knute Berger, who is saying we should upzone our single-family neighborhoods and why?
Oh, well, there is a committee that's advising the city on how to boost affordable housing. And a draft report that they this advisory group had put together was leaked to the Seattle Times. Danny Westneek got his hands on it, and one of the recommendations is that the single-family zone, which is the zoning for much of the city, that be eliminated, and that these sort of transitional zones be created that would allow more housing and more kinds of housing in neighborhoods that have been traditionally single-family. When you actually read the report, it's much more nuanced than that, and there's a lot of recommendations, good and bad, in the draft report. And anyway, that's why we're hearing about it, is because they're supposed to make their final recommendations to the mayor, and this is going to inform all kinds of things, changes in terms of permitting, zoning, potentially taxation, and a whole host of things.
You can imagine this is controversial. One part of this draft report that's especially controversial is that it says Seattle zoning, it's not just about affordability and types of housing and lower income people. It also says Seattle's zoning has roots in racial and class exclusion. The head of the Queen Anne Community Council told the Seattle Weekly, "I'm offended. People want a little bit of space, and then for them to imply that you are racist if you live in a single-family neighborhood, this may be a wake-up call for this city." Seattle is a pretty segregated city. How much should the city be taking race into account when it comes to housing policy? Former legislator Chris Vance with us. Hey, Chris.
This is not an issue about race. I mean, I voted for the Growth Management Act when I was in the legislature. I was the chairman of the King County Council's Growth Management Committee when we drafted the original 20-year comprehensive plan for King County. I like to think I know a lot about zoning and planning and growth management, and I'm all for good, solid planning. But this is social engineering driven by ideology run amok. It's crazy. You do not go into established neighborhoods and radically change their zoning because you have some philosophical belief about how people should live their lives.
Now, wait a minute. Radically change. We're not talking about high-rise apartments on Thackeray Lane in Wallingford. We're talking about allowing, in single-family neighborhoods, allowing people to have mother-in-law units, duplexes, backyard cottages. How radical is that?
Upzoning away from single family in neighborhoods like that is a radical change. And citizens are going to react that way, and they should. You don't need to have the same type of zoning in every neighborhood in the city of Seattle. There are places.
It wouldn't all be the same. There's business, there's multifamily, there's low density.
I understand. But tell that to homeowners in Magnolia, Queen Anne, and West Seattle, who will suddenly see their property values and the character of their neighborhood affected by this, and all because some planner has some ideology and philosophy in their head. This is not going to happen. Democracy won't let it happen, and it shouldn't happen. This is not good planning. This is social engineering.
Also with us, journalist with Al Jazeera America, contributor to KUOW, 2015 Knight Fellow, Tanya Mosley. Hi, Tanya. What do you think of all this?
So I can't believe, I mean, I'm just amazed that we keep having these discussions about housing without really tackling transportation. I don't see how, you know, I know about New York, I know about Chicago, and I know quite a lot about Chicago, for instance. And I know, of course, they have different zoning rules, and they have this type of housing in these areas that used to be purely residential single family homes, but they also have the infrastructure with transportation to support that. You can hop on a train and get anywhere within the city. If you're going to have this big change happen, and then we still have these trolleys and we still have buses as a means to get people and cars, it makes no sense. I mean, it's ridiculous, this idea that we would change that. And also the racial dynamic there, it's much deeper than that. The reason why you're not seeing minorities in other places within the city than the fact that there aren't these multiple housing units that they can afford. I mean, I think that that is simplistic, and that's too simplistic when we're talking about this issue.
Yeah, I think one of the things that people take offense at is the idea that there's something particularly racist about living in a single family home. I mean, that was the implication. If you read the report, you can see that what they're trying to do is address racial and class issues kind of across the city. Those race issues have affected multifamily housing and where it's located, and redlining. We have racial issues about housing right now. They discovered that minority applicants for certain rental properties on Capitol Hill were being turned away at higher rates. We have a company, Amazon, which is driving huge amounts of our growth that is essentially all white, all male, affluent singles that come to this city. You know, there are racial components of the growth. There's racial components of all the issues. So the idea that it's somehow the particular responsibility of single family neighborhoods, I think, is Tanya is exactly right. It's very simplistic, and it's guaranteed to generate unnecessary hostility.
Yeah, there's a quote. There's a quote in Danny Westmead's column from the report that talks about we have to get away from this idea that all Americans have the right to own their own home. And it's an attitude.
Single family home.
It's an attitude that I am very familiar with, that you get in these liberal, elitist downtown Seattle planners who try and change the world through planning and zoning. And very often in the King County Council, that sort of stuff would come to us and we'd water it back down because we elected officials actually have to be responsive to what people want. And
wait a second. It's the zoning that is that the ideology is the zoning. If it were just a free market Republican, do what you want, then we wouldn't be preserving single. The agenda is behind imposing government zoning rules that preserve single family housing.
If we were talking about drawing the first original plat map and the first original zoning for raw land in the city of Seattle, maybe. But it's when you try and use the power of zoning to change a neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And that is what people will not tolerate and shouldn't tolerate.
Even if it's removing zoning, removing government restrictions on, for example, multifamily housing in a neighborhood.
Yes, because
that's ideological.
Good planning is partially about respecting what's happened in that neighborhood already. The city of Seattle must meet its housing goals under the Growth Management Act. That's not an issue here. There's going to be plenty of housing stock to meet those goals. This is just somebody who thinks that it's wrong to live in a house, have a yard, and drive a car. And that attitude is out there among, you know, frankly, the far left. And the voters just aren't going to put up with it.
And Knut, you spoke a little bit. I have not read the report, but I've just read all of the reports about the report. And you talked a little bit about it's much more nuanced than that. There are more details that really go into play if this becomes something that's real. But I guess my question is, I really don't want the fate of single family housing. I don't even want this put up as an option and then ultimately voted on. And if this were to happen, because we can't really put the stake of the city. We can't believe that folks who are out there to make money will have our best interest at heart. I mean, it just makes
talking about developers.
Developers, yes, absolutely.
This
to
is
say, okay,
this
yeah,
is
we're gonna have a certain amount here and a certain amount here, but yet it's an open space and it's open wide for them to do what they want.
Right. Well, this draft report is an interesting amalgamation of socialism and free market capitalism.
Right.
And in some ways, they seem to contradict each other. You have Chris Vance on the one hand saying, you know, the zoning it should be inviolate when it comes to these existing neighborhoods. On the other hand, you have a lot of liberal urbanist advocates basically making an argument that John Boehner would make economically, which is we need to deregulate development And there are a lot of deregulation proposals in this report that concern me a lot more than the opening of the single family zones, and increase housing supply dramatically, as if that increase in and of itself will suddenly create social justice. Mm-hmm. The market, as you pointed out, Tanya, is not unbiased. And so this report is clearly struggling with controlling but not controlling too much, and trying to socially engineer. I think Chris is right that that's what's happening. I happen to think that's a good thing. Even though I don't agree with some of the decisions or some of the proposals, I think zoning is social engineering. I think it's fine. I think it's appropriate. We know it's constitutional. So the question is, what are the values you do that zoning by?
Let's get at what this says about us before we leave this topic. One of many, many examples at our Facebook page, Shannon says her first word, all caps, nightmare. The integrity of our historical neighborhoods has already been ruined beyond repair in so many cases. It's this idea of Seattle's special character. But Seattle is going to change. Seattle has a suburban character. When we say special character, we mean a suburban character. We don't Seattle residents don't think, they think, well, I live in a city. But if you are living in a suburban lifestyle, if you have a garage and a car and a yard and your single family home.
Really? I mean, I've lived in quite a few cities. I've been in Seattle for 10 years, but I've lived in Louisville, Kentucky. I've lived in Indiana. I've lived in Michigan, and I've been to Chicago extensively. I will say that in every major city, there's still neighborhoods. There's still single family homes,
yeah,
with garages.
That's suburban living in the city. It's fantastic.
But that still makes up a city. It's
yes.
not. I mean, it's.
Yes, it does. It does. But my question is, what is it about us that we want to preserve that and say the past is good and that changing? We want to densify, right? We don't want sprawl. We want to densify. But how you're talking about densifying changing history, you're on the wrong side of history.
Look, it's not so much. It's not about history, and it's not about. This is not an academic exercise. This is real people who invest their life savings in houses. And suddenly you come in and change their zoning and change the character of their neighborhood.
This and their property value.
We're not discussing a seminar here. This is real world stuff.
Yeah.
And people, homeowners have rights. Property owners have rights. And you can't just come into their neighborhood and radically change the character of their neighborhood because somebody with a master's degree in planning thinks it's a good idea.
Okay, it's, property values.
Government doesn't work
that
way.
I have to say, though, too, that, I mean, I'm more concerned that it's under the guise of providing equity, both those economically and also those racially. I mean, can I just be frank and say Seattle really doesn't have a clue yet how to deal with the issue of racial inclusion and equity. I mean, they just don't. And so they come up with these plans.
I should point out that you're African-American, by the way.
I'm African-American. But I mean, I think even if I weren't, I think other people can see that there are these.
And Irish.
Yep. I remember. Yep. Show, yeah. Exactly. I mean, I think that when you have these people who don't have any context, any real understanding about minorities and how they work and how housing works for them, I mean, on a real level, I mean, it's really simplistic to say, okay, we open this up and get rid of this single housing code and then this is going to help. It's so naive.
Yeah, I think part of the problem isn't planning per se. It's bad planning, and it's also the way in which, as Chris pointed out, there's certain laws that hamper us from doing some of the kinds of plannings that you can do in other countries. Canada, for example, can do a lot more planning. You argue about whether that's good or bad, but it's true. And so I think I'll tell you one of the potential downsides. First of all, and I'm a historic preservationist. You know, preservationists are on the losing end of all these arguments. So they're not stopping anything from happening in Seattle. They're not. They are in full retreat.
And this is their Confederate flag.
And in fact, this plan specifically attacks some of the historic design review and environmental review protections that historic districts count on. So history's not the issue here. But I heard last night, I was at a conference or a presentation at the Museum of History and Industry's Innovation Center. And they had a bunch of techies down there and tech investors talking about the future of Seattle. And they were very critical. It was interesting, kind of as a group, very critical of South Lake Union. And these guys, some of them even have businesses in South Lake Union. And it was very interesting. It's like, well, you guys, it was built for you. You know, why don't you like it? They didn't like the planning. They didn't feel that Seattle had done it in a smart, integrated, future-looking way. And you ended up with something that a lot of people think it's good for certain kinds of business to a point, but it's fairly soulless. And they were saying the innovation economy requires on people wanting to move to Seattle for livability. So the issue is, how do you have a modern, denser, livable city that still attracts people? And one of the ways you do that is by protecting some of those neighborhoods and other elements that create the overall whole.
Okay, we will talk so much more about this. This report hasn't even come out yet.
Right.
Again, Seattle put together this committee to deal with affordable housing. A draft was leaked. It included upzoning Seattle's single-family neighborhoods to increase the housing stock, maybe to rectify racial and class-based injustice. I don't know whether that sentence is even going to be in the report when it actually comes out on Monday. And as for what it says about us, you've heard a lot here. Seattle is reacting with soul or integrity or nostalgia or
social engineering.
Reacting against social engineering, and wait till the actual committee report comes out on Monday. This is the Week in Review. Coming up, Washington State voters said reduce class sizes. The legislature said no, at least not now. How do they get away with that? That's coming up in 20 minutes. KUOW's Week in Review, discussing, learning from the week's top stories, and live tweeting at KUOW. The president of the Seattle City Council wants to tax gun retailers for every gun and every bullet they sell in the city. $25 per gun, a nickel for every round of ammunition sold. Tim Burgess told us the money collected would pay for gun violence prevention programs.
Gun violence causes a tremendous amount of harm in our city and costs city taxpayers millions of dollars a year. And it's time that the gun industry chip in and help defray those costs.
Chris Vance, you just heard Tim Burgess say a tax on gun sales would defray the cost of guns. What effect do you think it would have?
Well, I understand how Americans feel about guns. It's something that divides Americans right down the middle. But I have to point out that both our federal and state constitution, in the Bill of Rights of both documents, says that Americans have an individual right to own firearms in term for self-defense. If you don't believe that the federal Second Amendment says that, read the Washington State Constitution, Article 1, Section 24.
No one's saying they don't have a right to own the guns. It's
right.
Just a tax sale.
And so if you are imposing a tax that is punitive, intended to punish people.
He didn't say it was punitive. He said it was to pay for gun prevention programs.
Or if you're trying to discourage people from owning guns.
He didn't say that.
Or in any way taking action that results in impairing the right of individuals to own firearms, it's almost certainly to be found unconstitutional. If Seattle goes too far, maybe they can get away with this, but if Seattle goes too far with this, that it actually becomes de facto gun control, it will be struck down.
But they're not going to go too far with this because they're only like two gun shops in the city of Seattle. I mean, we're not talking, so people will just go out of the city to buy their guns and not have to pay more, or those who own gun shops will then get more business outside of the city, and then maybe these businesses, these two gun shops, will then have to close their businesses. So, I mean,
Chris, what about that? No people will go to Bellevue. There's no impairment. There's no problem.
So we're going to put a couple people out of business, and we're all okay with that. Again, the way gun politics works is if this tax actually is impactful, you can just see the NRA will come in on behalf of those two gun stores and file a constitutional challenge to it. There'll be bills in Olympia. I mean, this looks like a new tool for folks who want to deny what the Constitution says to try and prevent people from owning firearms. And I'm just saying, it's unconstitutional. You can't do it.
You're reading into intent there that it's punitive.
It's not hard to do.
Knute Berger?
Oh, I think it's a great idea. And I think the fact that the money would, whatever amount it raises, some millions of dollars, it would raise.
I've heard somewhere between $400,000 or $500,000.
Okay, $400,000 or $500,000. But that, if that's actually put into a useful program.
$0 if all the gun sellers move out of Seattle.
Burgess has outlined in an op-ed outlined some ideas for what could be done with that money, and cited having some kind of program that would help steer people away from gun violence and that kind of thing. So I think it's something the city would support. I think it's a good idea. The city thinks it will pass muster because it's a tax, not a ban, which we don't have the right to do according to state law. So. I think it's a good progressive idea, and I think it'll have a lot of support.
I would love to know more about these prevention programs, because statistically, crimes aren't committed by law-abiding citizens who own guns, who own firearms. So we're talking about guns that are stolen. We're talking about guns that are illegally purchased. So we're talking about like this underground element there, and we're not really talking about those who are going to gun stores and lawfully buying guns. There are cases that happen. We know them. They're in the news. And because we know them, they are so rare that they become big issues, and then they become the issue that we hold up to say this is the rallying cry for change, when they are all, every day there's gun violence, and every day there are instances where people are hurt by illegal firearms or firearms that are under the market.
So I want to know where the ACLU is on this. You know, everyone loves to rush to defend your constitutional rights. Well, okay, there's nothing in the Constitution that says I have a right to own a car. There's nothing in the Constitution that says that I have a right to own a swimming pool or whatever. But the Constitution is crystal clear that Americans have the right to bear arms and own firearms. All the way back to the McCulloch versus Maryland case, it's been decided that the power to tax is the power to destroy. So using taxes to punish someone for exercising a right that is enumerated in the bill. Imagine if we were going to tax.
You keep saying punish. That's coming from you.
This is why we don't tax churches. This is why we don't tax or don't try and use punitive type taxes to punish the media, because it's protected free speech and protected religion. And right alongside the right for free speech and the right to exercise your religion is the right to own firearms. That's an inconvenient truth for some people. I'm sorry. Read the Constitution.
Well, it's not. Nobody has a right to buy cheap firearms.
Yes, you do.
And
yes, you do.
You can buy them, and you can go to a gun show or you know whatever.
After you go through the background check.
The other element, which I think is also a good idea, the other element that Tanya raised is illegal firearms. One of the other proposals that's part of this package is that it would require people who have their guns stolen to report those thefts. In other words,
who doesn't report the theft of a gun?
Apparently, a lot of people.
Why?
Don't report it.
Because a lot of gun owners believe that if they let the government know that they ever had the gun in the first place, that eventually it's going to be confiscated.
Oh.
Because there is a lot of paranoia.
And then oftentimes people don't know their guns are stolen, quite honestly. I've done stories where it's, you know, they have it up in a glove box somewhere in their home. There was some sort of robbery, burglary in their home. And then they find out months later, oh, yeah, that gun up there was stolen. That happens.
And that's not a unique law. I mean, that's a law that a lot of places have.
Okay. So my opening question was, what effect would this gun tax have in Seattle? Again, city council president wants to tax gun retailers for every gun and bullet they sell in the city to pay for gun violence prevention programs. Tanya essentially said zero effect, or not much effect, because that legal gun purchases is not the problem. Chris Vance thinks that this has the effect of infringing on a constitutional right. And Knut?
People will drive 100 miles to save $5. So, you know, I think if you're running a gun shop in Bellevue, you're probably going to see some benefit.
But the NRA and other gun groups will see this. If one city is able to do this and get away with it, it could become a tool used elsewhere. I can't imagine that they'll let this go without a fight, and it's a fight that they will win, because the Constitution says this right can't be impaired. It's a very high standard.
All right, legal fight to come, and we'll follow that on KUOW. Coming up on the Week in Review, we told Washington State high school students they had to pass a biology test to graduate. Some of them failed it repeatedly, and we're going to let them graduate anyway. What lesson are we teaching them? That's coming up in 20 minutes. KUOW's Week in Review, covering, debating, discussing, learning from the news of the week, and live tweeting the show. Join us on Twitter at KUOW. This week, an ice cave in the Mount Baker Snoqualmie National Forest collapsed. It killed a 34-year-old woman and hurt five other people. These ice caves, if you haven't seen them, they are wondrous. They're fun. Thousands of people go there safely. But they are inherently unstable, and they've been hurting and killing people for years. An 11-year-old girl died five summers ago. Why haven't the ice caves been roped off for safety? On the line with us, Mount Baker Snoqualmie Forest Supervisor Steve Kennan. Steve, welcome.
Thank you, Bill.
You do have clear signs up around those ice caves warning collapsing snowfields, but why not post a sign that says do not enter and rope off the mouth of the ice caves?
You know, we've had a situation over the several years ago. The bridge for that particular access point was out. People crossed the river to get over onto the trail and access the site anyway. There's a lot of popular demand. This has been a very popular area since the 1920s when it was initially opened and established as a, I think there was a recreational lodge in the area back then. And so a lot of people have come to enjoy the wondrous, as you pointed, the wondrous site and viewpoint of this area.
Well, people will ignore ropes, but you're already telling them not to go in the caves. The kiosk at the trailhead says, do not enter the ice caves. Why not back that up with a rope?
Given the dynamic nature of the area, it'd be very difficult to kind of establish a perimeter that would actually be a well-defined area. What we have done is we have established a very clearly articulated terminus at the trailhead and at the end of the trail, which clearly identifies here's where we deem the safe location to be to observe and enjoy the beauty of the area.
Okay, so you're saying the difference between, for example, we have railings that keep people away from a dangerous ledge, but you're saying the difference here is that this is a glacier. The ice cave, it retreats and advances, and that's why we can't just perimeter it off?
Well, and the way this works is the ice caves is actually a yearly event. It's a naturally occurring event where avalanches and snow and debris fall off the Big Four mountain on the north side and land at the base every year. And every year what ends up happening is the ice and snow melt from the remaining ice and snow from the top of Big Four and at the base of the Big Four where the snow accumulates. As it melts, it creates water, and that water runs out, and it melts out these ice caves. So it melts throughout the course of the summer, and then in the fall, winter, it reestablishes and reaccumulates. So it's a real dynamic and ever-changing system, so it's really difficult to kind of identify exactly where we'd rope it off. But we've tried to identify that through the trail system, through the signs, through media coverage. We've actually done a whole lot of stuff this spring with the local media to try to let people know it's a pretty dangerous and dynamic environment out there. So very, very much we want people to be careful.
Final question then. Will the Forest Service change anything in light of this week's death and injuries? Will anything change at the Big Four ice caves?
I think right now it's a little bit too early for me to say. We're going to continue to have a dialogue and assess the situation. We're going to bring in the local community. We're going to bring in some scientists, maybe some folks from the Avalanche Center or some glaciologists who might be able to help us understand the dynamic nature of these ice caves and figuring out what can we do to provide a more safe environment for visitors. But right now we haven't made any decision yet. We're in the process of we have a temporary closure, and we're in the process of evaluating and determining what our next steps will be.
Mount Baker Snoqualmie Forest Supervisor Steve Kennan, we know that you're feeling the loss here with this death and these injuries too, and you're trying to figure this out, and we really appreciate you joining us.
Well, thank you very much, Bill, and I do want to say that the Forest Service is deeply saddened by the tragic events that occurred on Monday. And again, the warning for people is it's in that particular area, it's very dynamic and very dangerous, so please be careful.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
So how? What do you make of that? How should we decide which risks are too risky to rope off, especially when it's a changing natural environment?
Well, I'll tell you, I my condolences for the families involved in this. I covered back in 2010, Grace Tam, the young girl that was killed out there. I was actually in the newsroom the day we heard over the scanners that something had happened, and we went out there. And since then, I'd covered it for the following 2 years, including the lawsuit that the family filed against the Forest Service. I will say, I mean, it's such a tragedy. At the same time, it's such a beautiful natural occurring event, and I can see how people are lured to it. When I was there, I thought, wow, this is amazing. How much do we need to have this? How much do we need to really police people? I mean, there are clear signs. There are signs on the way up to the trail. There are signs when you get to the ice caves. How much do you need to tell people, and how much do you need to police? I guess that's the question. I'd love to know how you all feel about it.
Skiers,
where do you come down on it, Tanya? Before have you just sounds like you haven't decided yourself.
I mean, I think the only other thing to do would be to say that the ice caves aren't available to the public to be able to view, because you really can't, as he said on the phone just now, you can't rope it off. Every year it looks different, it feels different based on just our environment, and so that's not feasible to do. They can't have someone out there policing people all of the time. They have the signs out there, it's very clear. I don't really know what else they could do.
Okay.
Yeah, I've never been there, so I can't comment intelligently on the physical characteristics of it. I do know I've been lots of places in my life where there's signs saying, don't do this, don't go here, and people do it anyway. If the Forest Service can physically prevent people from doing what the Forest Service knows is dangerous, they should. I don't know if they can or can't. But I don't think it would, I'm not sure it would make a difference. I mean, skiers ignore signs all the time and go off trail and get killed because of it. I was in Hawaii and I saw all these signs saying stay away from this one blowhole thing, and people were right in the middle of it looking down into it. And human beings just are going to ignore the signs sometimes.
Canute?
One of the issues here, I think, that's, if somebody goes mountain
climbing.
By the way,
Canute, you've been many times to these.
Yeah, I've been up there many times. As a kid, summer camp, I've camped up there, familiar with it. I haven't been up there in years, but I'm familiar with it. And one of the issues is it's so easy to access. In other words, it's not something where you have to have mountaineering skills. It's not like you're up, you know, if you're up on a glacier on Mount Rainier and there's a crevasse and you fall in it, nobody's saying we should put, you know, something across that glacier so you can't fall. People understand that those people take risks. This is a little over a mile from the road. You know, people park. Little kids can go running down there. You're very excited when you see the ice caves. Everybody's instinct is they want to go in. That's kind of why you're there.
Yeah.
And it's pretty inside. It's interesting. Mm-hmm. Interesting formations and that kind of thing. So I understand what the appeal is. And if they wanted to prevent people from going in at all, they'd really have to just shut down the trail. And that then goes against the kind of public access and encouraging people to get out and see nature and experience it firsthand.
So to prevent people from going inside where it's dangerous, we'd have to prevent them from seeing this beauty.
Essentially, yeah. I think you would have to close off the entire trail. And because I think Chris is right. People are always going to ignore signs. There's obviously difficulty because of the fact that it's growing or melting. It's difficult to establish, as he said, the perimeter. It sounds like if you do establish that, you might be creating greater dangers, mm-hmm. My sense is educate people as much as possible. I would not take my granddaughter in there knowing what I know now, 40, 50 years ago.
But would you go in yourself?
Would I go in myself?
Yes.
Probably not.
This
no,
weekend?
I'm probably too much of a scaredy cat now. But
when you were younger.
When I was younger, I went in and didn't think anything of it. Mm-hmm. Didn't look dangerous to me. And I think that's one of the things is, you learn over time that nature can look really beautiful, but it'll get you.
The amazing thing is I remember when I was covering Grace Tam's death, and we went up to the ice caves, and it had just happened 2 days before, so we had been following it every day. There were people up there. There were people close to as close as they could get. And I was thinking, a girl just died. There's a cross right here that says that it happened 2 days ago. So, I mean, it's pretty interesting human behavior and what we will do and what we will ignore.
Yeah, if this were a human-made ride, you'd have to sign a waiver before. But it's something, if you're killed by nature, it's different. It's like, well, that's the way of things. You know, people are drawn to it, and they'll sometimes perish because of it. And it sounds like we'll accept that. I mean, none of us are saying close that trail.
Yeah, I certainly, in the broader picture, I certainly do accept that. It's part of the nature of natural parks.
Again, one woman is dead, 34-year-old hiker from California, another man in critical condition at Harborview, four more hurt after the Big Four ice caves near Glacier Peak partly collapsed. So we've been agonizing over the beautiful danger of nature. We've got more coming up on KUOW's Week in Review as we continue to learn from the big events of the week. Stay tuned. Welcome back to KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. Remember when Washington State voters passed an initiative ordering the legislature to reduce class sizes K through 12? This week, lawmakers voted not to do that, at least not for 4 years, because it's too expensive. Former legislator Chris Vance, how is it okay for legislators to ignore the voters?
Well, let's talk about the law. An initiative can be suspended, changed, amended, whatever, in the first 2 years with a two-thirds vote. After that, it's just a law. The legislature can change it. So it is legal for what the legislature did. But it's a very troubling policy decision. Now, the legislature is correct when they say that Initiative 1351 was very expensive and there was no obvious, easy way for them to fund it. But put this in context. We have some of the highest class sizes in the nation. The average class size in this country in grades 4 through 12 is 24 students. This initiative just tried to get us down to 25. Also, the class sizes in Initiative 1351 are part of what's called the prototypical school model, which the legislature itself developed, which they say they're going to fund, and which the Supreme Court is ordering them to fund in the McCleary case. Simply put, the class sizes in 1351 didn't come out of thin air. They came from the McCleary case. Even though they've suspended this initiative, the Supreme Court is still likely to order them to work to get to these class sizes. Eventually, the legislature has to sit down and have a serious discussion about how to find a new funding source to come up with the billions of dollars they need to meet their McCleary obligations, and that includes lower class sizes in grades 4 through 12.
So legally, I asked, how is it okay for the legislature to ignore the voters? Legally, well, it's a two-thirds majority, and they did that.
Yes.
Ethically, I guess you're saying... And, this is wrong.
And the big mistake everyone is making is separating 1351 from McCleary. Like the 1351 initiative just came out of nowhere. It didn't. The McCleary case requires lower class sizes in grades 4 through 12. 1351 is just part of that. Even though they've suspended the initiative, the Supreme Court is still likely to slap them and say, you have to come up with a plan to lower these class sizes.
Anybody disagree?
No, I don't disagree. I mean, we had a long talk beforehand about it. I'm just amazed that they can ignore the voters. And so to your question, how can they do this? And, you know, we're talking about reducing class sizes. And I'm just thinking about the actual children in those class sizes. Like, I'm taking it down to the teachers and the students, and how the fact that they can just kick the can just for another 4 years and say, okay, we are just going to deal with this in 4 years. And then what happens in 4 years? In the meantime, there are kids that are in oversized classes, and year by year goes by and our educational system is compromised.
Canute, is there no initiative that voters could pass that would be so irresponsible as to is it okay for the legislature to ignore something legally, two-thirds majority, when they've deemed this as an irresponsible demand by the public who don't understand budgeting?
Well, as Chris said, they certainly have the legal right to do it the way they did it. The question is, the voters keep passing initiatives saying, please lower class size.
Right.
And the legislature is mandated by the court to do that. Mm-hmm. And they continue to resist doing it to the extent that is required. They have bipartisan agreement that it's an inconvenient law.
Inconvenient.
And this is all about money.
They
don't want to raise taxes. They did the idea of the levy swap, of moving local levy authority into the state government to raise the state share of the property tax, was floated and shot down. There is just no political – it's about taxes. I mean, but what's really troubling is the legislature also is telling the court – that there's no educational research that shows that lower class sizes, grades 4 through 12, make a difference. That's absurd, and it's contrary to – Governor Gregoire appointed the Basic Education Finance Task Force, which developed the prototypical school model based on national research of what – the benefit of lower class size. Now the legislature is saying they just want to ignore the research that they themselves authorized – earlier.
Okay.
But it all comes down to not wanting to raise taxes.
So you could be okay with the legislature using their power to ignore the voters on if it was something, but this isn't it. This was a reasonable enough demand. Is that?
Well, it's legal.
It's legal, I
know. It's legal, but no, I don't think the legislature did the right thing. They need to step up and fund lower class sizes.
Yeah. Okay. KUOW's Week in Review. We're going to talk about the legislature ignoring another requirement. This has to do with the graduation requirement, and it has to do with cell division, I believe is my, what is it?
Wow, mitosis. Pulled that out of, somewhere deep in your brain.
Igneous rock or something like that. I didn't do so well myself in biology. Stay tuned to KUOW's Week in Review. Welcome back. KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. We're tweeting the show live at KUOW and discussing the news of the week. Remember, we told Washington State High School students that in order to graduate, they had to pass some exams, including a biology test. But this week, the legislature decided that 2,000 students who failed that test can still graduate. Chris Vance, you are a paid advisor to our superintendent of education. Why would we let students skate on a test?
Well, like so many things, I think you have to understand the context here. I was in the House with Randy Dorn back in 1993 when we passed House Bill 1209 and created the first statewide standards and statewide tests called the WASL, and said that kids for the first time ever had to pass a test to graduate. Since then, the legislature has changed our standards and changed the testing system over and over and over again. We've dumped our locally driven standards and replaced them with the National Common Core standards. Now we are changing the graduation requirement to say that kids have to pass the new SBAC test, which comes from the Common Core standards. But in the meantime...
Where are we headed here, Chris?
Well, in the meantime, kids are still having to pass these end-of-course tests, and one of them is in biology. So there was a revolt in the legislature against all this high-stakes testing. The bill that they wanted to get passed would have got rid of all the graduation tests. The Republicans in the Senate wouldn't go that far, so the compromise was, let's just get rid of the biology assessment, which was the newest one and the most difficult one and the one most kids had failed. But this is part of the bigger, really national battle over high-stakes testing.
But why do we have a biology requirement? You know, why not psychology? Why not computer science? Why biology?
Well, quickly, but there was supposed to be...
I get reading and math. I get that.
There was supposed to be a comprehensive science test, but the legislature around 2010, 2011 said instead we want to go to these specific course-driven classes. And out of all the science disciplines, they chose biology instead of chemistry or physics or anything else. I don't know. It was sort of a random choice, in my opinion. Actually, just picked biology.
So we're talking about thousands of kids who can't pass it, right?
There are 2,000 kids in this state who would not receive their diplomas this year, even though they'd met every other requirement, but had not passed the biology requirement.
Right. So this really speaks to me because way back in the day when I was in high school, we had something similar that happened. But these tests were implemented in order to graduate starting in 10th grade. And I actually had held a protest at my school over it because I knew that a lot of kids wouldn't be graduating because they couldn't pass these tests. And it's just amazing that, I mean, I graduated 2 decades ago from high school.
Mm-hmm.
And we're still having this discussion. We're still having kids, thousands of kids who can't pass a test. What does that say? How many times are we going to hit our head over and over and over against the wall until we figure out that this is not working? The standardized test model is not working. And maybe it does not signify how much these kids have learned over the 12 years that they've been in school. Is this a correct measure? I know we have to measure how well teachers have done, how well students have done. But really, you get to the point where it's your last year in high school, and now finally, hey, before you can actually leave this place, you got to sit down and take this test and mark in these circles.
I thought these kids have known since 10th grade that they had to pass this test, and they're able to take the test over and over until they pass it. I mean, at what point do we make a graduation requirement an actual requirement? Knut, you're staring.
I'm staring. Yeah,
What's the lesson we're sending our children?
Yeah, well, that the real world is chaotic. For one thing, I've never liked these kind of high stakes tests, particularly tests that are tied to funding. I think it kind of corrupts the system when you have them tied to school funding and teacher pay. One of the worries about the kids opting out of tests is we're going to lose federal funding that's tied to these things. That skews the motives of the test givers and I think the curriculum. One of the criticisms of this particular test was that many of the kids who failed could not go back and take biology again with a hope of passing a second time because the curriculum wouldn't allow that.
So you have a smartphone while you're at the movie theater waiting for your friends to show up. Go back and look at, remind yourself what cell division is.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I think things like smaller class sizes and other kinds of reforms about the way we can teach and assess people are much more valuable than these kinds of tests.
The key to this, if you're going to have high stakes testing, which I believe in, you have to set the bar at the right place. There is a difference between high school graduation and college entrance. And the problem is the WASL, way back when, was supposed to be a test of basic skills, the minimum we'd expect of kids before we give them their high school diploma. They set the bar too high, and half of all of our kids failed the math WASL. Now, the new Common Core standards are much more difficult than our state standards, and the new Common Core test is much more difficult, but the legislature insists they want to use it as the graduation requirement. In a democracy...
It's much more difficult than the WASL was?
Yes, and in a democracy, you can't have a system where 10, 20, 25, 30% of the kids don't walk across that stage. Voters won't tolerate it, and that then the whole regime...
Talk about disparity.
And we end up losing the ability to have accountability and standards. It's because they set the bar too high.
Okay, so the message to kids of lifting this requirement is...
I don't feel like it's a chaotic message. I mean, I know you're saying it as if we're saying, okay, we're giving you a free pass now.
No, Knut says, like, life is chaotic. He's against testing anyway. He thinks it's great. I'm okay with that. I'm just trying to figure out, continue, Tanya. What are we saying?
It's less about what we're saying to the kids and more about, okay, can we take a look at what's going to work? What is a model that's really going to work? Yes, these kids will get their high school diploma, but what about next year? What about the next year after that? I mean, I know that.
And what do you tell other kids who failed their requirements?
And Bill, you're on the right track. Teachers and kids, believe me, I know this for a fact, have noticed the fact that the legislature keeps changing its mind, and changing the system, and changing everything year after year. And kids get the message, oh, don't worry. If we don't pass, they'll change it. In over 20 years, we have not stuck with one system and been firm about it.
Okay. How firm should we be when we say use water wisely? That's in a moment. Again, just to reset what we just did, this is a budget compromise. Legislators delayed the biology exam requirement. It's going to allow hundreds of kids at least to graduate. We will be right back and tell you whether you ought to be conserving water or you ain't. Coming up on the Week in Review. Okay, wrapping up KUOW's Week in Review with Tanya Mosley, Chris Vance, and Knut Berger. Should you be conserving water or not? Water managers in the Puget Sound area have been telling us all summer that unlike eastern Washington, we have enough water. But this week, Seattle Public Utilities downgraded its water supply outlook from good to fair and asked customers to continue to use water wisely. Joining us now from SPU's water conservation team, Kelly O'Rourke. Hi, Kelly.
Hello.
SPU has four levels of conservation notices, I guess. There's an advisory, then there's voluntary conservation, then mandatory, then emergency. So where are we now? Are we at advisory?
Well, actually, we're at neither of those. So it does get a little complicated, but what you're talking about is when we're in curtailment, and we are not at all. There's water conservation, and there's curtailment. We have a water shortage contingency plan, which is the four stages you just mentioned, but we are actually not in that plan.
But aren't you advising us to use water wisely?
Use water wisely, as they should all the time year round.
Because I'm a rule follower, so I will obey. Can my kids run through the sprinkler?
We wish they wouldn't.
Would not.
We do have a series of outdoor water tips, which I can give you and your customers if you'd like.
A tip. It sounds like an advisory, but it's a tip. Don't run through the sprinkler. Can they wash my car?
Absolutely. Yeah, there are absolutely no restrictions from the City of Seattle, the regional water system. All we're doing is letting folks know that our demand has been a bit higher than we expected and reminding folks to use water more efficiently and telling folks some things we're doing on our system side to maximize our supply.
But how about a giant water slide by Seattle Center?
Sure, go there. Really, what we want people to do is year-round just be a smart user of water. It's a really important shared resource between people and fish and other environmental uses. And we have a great website, savingwater.org, that has tips for year-round conservation, indoor tips, outdoor tips. We have a great water conservation program, and we're always asking our customers just to be good, efficient users of their water. And we have great tips for outdoor water use and for indoor water use.
I'm just trying to figure out how to be good my whole life. Kelly O'Rourke from SPU, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, I'm glad that it's cooler now because we were doing the sprinkler thing every night, running through the sprinklers.
I didn't know I wasn't supposed to do that.
Yeah.
All right. Is that clear? It's not an advisory.
But I
use
see
water
you're
wisely.
Your head over,
well,
over there.
They need this whole thing inevitably goes into the climate debate because both sides say, "Oh, see, the drought." And government officials need to be clear. They need to either tell us.
I need to be clear. We have a few seconds left. There's the clock.
It'd be better if they'd say if everything's okay or there's a problem, but be clear about it.
Right. I need to know rules so I can follow them. Knut?
You want to pass a test?
Yes! I want to pass the biology test.
I talked to somebody at SPU, and they said the message was, just don't waste water.
Just don't waste. Whatever that means to you.
Whatever that
means
to you.
And we're not advising you. We're just saying. That's SPU's new slogan. Seattle Public Utilities.
We're just saying.
We're just saying this has been the Week in Review with Tanya Mosley, a journalist with Al Jazeera America, Knut Berger, Mossback at Crosscut.com, Chris Vance, public policy consultant, former state GOP chair. Tanya, have a great time at your 2015 Knight Fellowship.
Thank you.
Out in California. Get the podcast of the show. You can listen to us while you're not watering your garden. Jason Pagano is our producer. I'm Bill Radke. Come see us next Friday, University Heights Center. We'll be in front of a live audience, including you, University Heights Center. Thank you.